Okay, so welcome to the show, Environmental Harmony Podcast, Sydney. I'm so glad you were able to make time to talk with me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm really excited
Absolutely.
to have a discussion with you.
Absolutely. So you are a natural dyeing master from what I've seen. You have an amazing Instagram presence. And could you just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your business and what you do?
Yeah, so my name is Sydney Goss, and my business is called Sydney Goss Silks. And I just wanted to, have something really, really simple for people to remember. But my business is essentially I make products. I have a complete dye garden that I pull from in terms of, natural color and botanicals. And I teach classes as well. So my garden fuels how I make my products and how I teach classes. So it's a completely sustainable model, which is something that I really value. And I think if you're a natural dyer, that's something that's really important is, how can you be as natural as possible? So
Yeah, it's like that connection with the land. You're bringing it full circle by growing all of your own products as well.
yes.
Now you just have to start raising silkworms.
I know.
Yeah.
Weaving my own silk.
So, how did you begin down this journey?
So, I was in New York State working on my master's in sculpture, and I definitely was interested in a more fiber-based concentration for some of my thesis work. So, I was working with paper making, basic garment construction to make, contemporary sculpture. But as I was working with these materials, I thought, how can I alter the color in a natural way? And so I just started doing my own research, and at first it was very trial and error. There's so many different components to natural dyeing that you kind of have to understand before your natural color is more permanent, and how you extract color from natural plants, barks, even bugs. And so it's pretty multi-layered and complex in that way. But so I just started with like the basics. I used like avocado skins and avocado pits to bring out a nice like mauvey pink. And I experimented with dyeing paper pulp with that color and dyeing fabric with that color to bring into my sculptural work. And to me, it just gave the work a more thoughtful depth. It became more
Yeah,
poetic
absolutely.
once food waste was used to color this fiber that I then manipulated even more. So I would say it all kind of started there. From that, once I graduated, I got obsessed, and I always tell people in my classes that like, you will become obsessed with this. So like, tread lightly. If you're not in the market for a new hobby, maybe don't try this because you won't be able to stop.
What a great hobby, though. I mean, I can imagine so many things that I have that I would love to try this on.
Yeah, and then you start wondering like, well, could this give me a dye? Could this give me, a different color? So it's just like this process that begs to be figured out. And I think that that's what I was like super attracted to when it came to it, is that it was endless. So after I was self-taught for like a year, maybe, that's when I was like, okay, I'm kind of reaching this point where everything's kind of a pastel color and I really want richer tones. Like, how can I learn more about mordanting techniques? So I just started taking classes with people who were, in my opinion, true masters of certain dye techniques. So I took a cochineal class with an indigenous cochineal grower up in New York.
What's cochineal?
So cochineal is a parasite or pest that attaches itself to prickly pear cactus.
Does it create that white fuzziness?
Yes, so it
Okay,
creates
I've seen that.
the white kind of fuzzy mold on a cactus paddle. But
And
at
it's
that
bright
point,
red. I've noticed it doing landscaping, like we'll remove that just by hand, and it's like a bright red. Is that the color of the dye that you get from it?
So it's
Oh, interesting.
you can get multiple colors from it. It ranges, but you kind of scrape it off the paddle, and you can kind of grind it down, or you can draw a bath with it, and it can give you basic magentas, different fuchsia tones, but you can push it using, different alkaline methods or acidic methods to either a bright like flag red or a really rich purple.
Wow.
So luckily I had access to a cochineal grower up in Ithaca, New York, and his family was back in Mexico, had a huge prickly pear farm, and so they actually harvest the cochineal. And so I was able to learn from someone who could teach me more of like an authentic way of extracting that color, and respecting that color. And so that class was, it changed everything for me.
Wow. So you
And
talk
then
about adding more like acidic or alkaline ingredients. What are you using as inputs? I assume that's like in a bath kind of scenario when you're soaking the, is it cochineal or cochineal?
it's cochineal.
Cochineal.
That's how Jose pronounced it, was like a, instead of a CH, more of an SH, cochineal.
Cochineal, okay.
So basically, once you grind those little bugs and you create that like magenta powder, you then add it to a pot of, 5 gallons of distilled water. It's really important to work with distilled, because some of our water can be harder, or just have other agents in it that can alter that color, and that may not be your plan. But so with cochineal, we worked specifically with distilled water so that we could get its true color, which is that really beautiful pink. One of my tasks during the class was to actually juice a whole bunch of limes. And so we used limes to push it to a more acidic bath, which, the smells that started to enter the space while we were working was like intoxicating. So we used lime as our acid. And then for our base, we actually used soda ash. So more of like a chemical agent to push it to that cooler, purple color, but we could have used baking soda, I think. There's a whole bunch of different like basic, agents that we could have used, but we used soda ash, and that brought it to this like rich grapey kind of purple, which was beautiful.
That sounds super beautiful. So with this process, I've tried dyeing things just with coffee grounds or like onion skins. And I haven't looked into it at all. It's just, it's so fascinating. It's such a huge creative world. That's why I wanted to have you come on and talk about it. But I know there's an aspect there that I'm missing. That's like, you have to have something to fix the color, right? Were you saying that's the mordant?
Yes. So mordanting is, it's basically just as important as finding color, essentially, because if you don't properly mordant your fiber, that color is just going to stain it rather than dye the cloth. And that was the issue that I was running into in the beginning as well, is like, what is a mordant? How do I measure a mordant? Do mordants shift based on the type of fiber that I'm using? And that's where it gets more complicated. And then there's also, I like to think of it as a gift from like the natural dye gods. certain dyes that don't require a mordant. Onion skins being one of them.
Ooh.
Pomegranate skins. Let's
Excuse
see
me.
what else. The avocado pits and skins don't require a mordant either. But essentially, a mordant is a way to fix the fiber so that the natural color bonds to the fiber. So, for, I won't go super into it, but for something like cotton fabric, you would want to use aluminum acetate. And for
What
protein,
is, just to clarify, what is that derived from? Because like obviously this is such an ancient practice. So I love looking back at like what would our grandmothers have used to get aluminum acetate?
well, so I can't really answer that for you, but what I can say is historically, urine was actually
Really?
used as a mordant. And I
Interesting.
think this was probably more during the Renaissance era, because we had ammonia in our urine, and that was just kind of like a natural agent to help that color bond to the fiber. But now we've got aluminum acetate, so we use that for cellulose stuff. So like cotton, linen, bamboo, you would want to use aluminum acetate, and that's just sold as like a really fine powder. And then for protein fibers like silk, wool, let's see, alpaca, those fibers would call for aluminum sulfate. So,
Interesting.
yeah, the two work on the fiber in different ways. There's different heating components for each.
So like every type of fiber, you'd have to use a different kind of measurement of mordant and a different heat. And so then you're heating the fiber with the aluminum sulfate or acetate and like it's saturating it and then it will absorb the dyes.
Yeah, so basically the natural color attaches itself to that aluminum. So
Gotcha.
it's not really attaching itself to the fiber necessarily, as it is more to the mordant itself. But like I said, there are some gifts where we can actually use different dye baths without a mordant, because there's a high tannin yield in the dye stuff itself. So that is almost acting as your mordant.
Wow. And does that go across all the different fiber categories? So like protein fibers you were just mentioning, or the plant cellulose fibers?
Yeah. So yeah, basically, if there's high tannin content in the dye stuff, then that it's kind of like a mordant and a dye all in one, and it's works for any type of fiber. Naturally,
Wow.
of course, you can't dye any synthetic fiber with
Right.
color, unfortunately.
I know. Since I started becoming aware of like living fibers, and my sister-in-law is Romanian, and she's really conscious of things like that. I think just because their culture is still so, it's almost like they're in like the 40s or 50s comparatively, like technologically, to where we are in America. And she always talks about wearing living clothing, and she'll re-dye her clothing over and over again.
Yeah, so a lot of dyers talk about how it's living color, essentially, because while a mordant makes it more permanent, certain dyes respond differently to just being out in the sun, having that UV exposure, or being washed multiple times. So they do fade over time, and I think that that's the beauty of it. And like your sister-in-law was saying, that living color is that it's constantly in a state of flux almost. You can try to preserve it as that rich tone for as long as you can, but ultimately it will shift over time. And again, like being able to go back in and alter that color, re-dye it again, is what makes this technique and process so intriguing, I think, is that you can just constantly change your clothes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Change the textiles that you have in your life, and make them exciting and new again.
Right. That's what makes it so sustainable as well. And then it feels really special and meaningful, like you're wearing something of value that's personal, I'm sure.
Yeah, and sometimes I'll even think, okay, if I dye this silk blouse in indigo right now, and I know that this indigo will fade, what would be another color that I would want to add on top of it so that I could potentially get a green out of this blouse? So I try to think, ahead as well, like, what could I put on top of this? What could I, and redyeing it with the same color also is another option. But it's just fun to think of your garments or your wardrobe shifting.
Absolutely. So you did your study with Jose, and how did this all move on from there? Because now you have this beautiful business and you're growing your own dye plants.
Yeah. So I would say after I had the class with Jose, let's see, there was some time in the middle where I was doing some more experiments and then COVID hit. So we were in lockdown. And I'll just do a little shout out to Botanical Colors. They're a natural dye company out in Seattle. They started hosting online workshops during lockdown and inviting some of the most well-known dyers to kind of facilitate those workshops. So I signed up to take an indigo class with Abubakar Fofana, who doesn't like to say that he's a master of indigo, but in my opinion, I definitely think that he is. And we, I think for 3 or 5 days, we learned how to draw up a natural fructose indigo vat as a class online. He
Wow.
was in France. We were all over the world. And we were shipped the materials from Botanical Colors, so we had everything we needed. You just had to, like, acquire pots and pans and buckets.
That sounds like so much fun.
But that was honestly, I would say that, between Jose's class and Abubakar's class, that was where I learned the most. It was the most robust knowledge that I could have, been exposed to. Abubakar is from West Africa, has an indigo farm, and dyes cloth with indigo as his full-time, career feels like a funny word, but it's like what he does with his life is indigo. Everything is about blue. And it was a very spiritual class. It wasn't just about learning the chemistry. It was about, again, respecting the color, the history, the origin of indigo, acknowledging that it has been abused by white settlers in the States and in other countries as well. And then learning how to kind of decolonize that dye as we're learning these very specific things about it. So once I completed that class, I was just like on fire for everything. Those two classes taught me a lot about solid-based dyeing techniques. And then from there, I said, okay, eco printing. I know that this is the thing that I haven't tackled yet. And then bundle dyeing, of course, which is kind of like a sister to eco printing. And that's
Can you
basically how
describe,
we
like
work.
you just said solid base printing. So what is that?
Well, so I was working with solid dyes, so changing a square or a yard of cloth from white to pink, or from white to blue. And bundle dyeing and eco printing allows you to have a multicolored cloth
Okay.
with different dye stuff. But eco printing is essentially what I do specifically now, which is taking a botanical, like a flower, petal, leaf, laying that out on more into cloth, bundling it up between a rigid core and a resist, and steaming it. And while you steam it, that natural color transfers onto that fiber and makes a pretty clear print of that flower or of that leaf. And so it's essentially capturing the memory of that flower, if you will, and imprinting it onto the fabric.
Yeah, it's almost like photography.
Yeah, and sometimes your prints can be that clear where you can see the lines and the petals. And to me, that was such a, while I love everything about natural dyes, that was such a rewarding technique to learn. And I think that that's why I've been more fixated on it, is that then it was like, okay, well, what can I, will this leaf print? Will this flower print? Working out different steam times for all of those. I was really interested in that. And so my dye garden now has all botanicals that are able to be eco printed with.
Wow. So when you describe this process, you said you sandwich your cloth with that's soaked in mordant between a rigid core and what was the other word you said? A resist?
Yeah, a resist.
What is that?
So a resist, it has a lot of different definitions depending on how you're using it, but within this context, I'm merely just using a plastic sheet between the cloth so that it doesn't continue to print over on itself repeatedly, but instead has a single print in one spot, and that plastic allows that because I'm bundling that fiber up on a copper pipe, which is that rigid core. It will touch itself as I roll it again and again and again. So the resist acts as that barrier so that I can just print that flower in that one spot.
Gotcha, that makes sense. And
Yeah.
then are you using an iron or how, what's your steaming methodology?
I just have these giant aluminum pots with a steaming basket in the base, and I add the completely bundled fabric on the copper pipe to that pot, add my lid on, and steam it for, it depends on what I'm using, but it generally is like 7 to 10 minutes of a steam time.
Wow.
And once you unbundle it, it's done. So it looks easy in person because you're like, wow, that took like 7 or 10 minutes. But what you're not calculating is how long it took to mordant, how long it took to grow that plant,
Yeah,
how long
absolutely.
it took to until the plant flowered, you know.
Right.
So
And to develop the knowledge and answer all these questions that you're shedding some light on right now.
yeah. So, it is a long process, but like I said, that the last part of it, when you finally get to be creative, lay out your pattern of botanicals and bundle that up, that's like the Christmas morning of the whole practice. It's
Yeah.
exciting, it's quick. And then after that, you've got a beautiful textile.
But what point did you decide you wanted to do this in a business capacity?
Well, one thing that is interesting and annoying and fun about natural dyeing is because you're experimenting so much, you just have all these samples all the time. You're just like, okay, I need to dye something green now and pink and purple. And then you're left with all of these swatches. Which is great if you're into like quilting or making your own clothes. I am not interested in those things. So I was like only dyeing silk scarves to really learn, color, and mordants. And then I just had all of these silk scarves. So I was like, okay, I have so many friends that would love to wear this. And I just started selling them for super cheap, like $25 a scarf, so that I could continue to buy more silk scarves.
Fund your learning.
And make more experiments. So it kind of naturally like fed into this little business. And then once I learned eco printing, that's where I just couldn't stop. And okay, like this flower is blooming right now. I'm gonna wait for this flower to bloom. And then, like I said before, I was just left with all these little silk samples of work. So people just really started to love it. They're like, I want one like this. Can I commission you to do this? And so it just like organically grew into the business that it is today. So now I do different size silk scarves. I do tapestries, and occasionally I'll do like yardage for like a designer if they want like silk yardage for a particular project. So,
Wow, can imagine that's gorgeous. The possibilities are endless.
yeah, truly.
Have you done any? I would think like a bedspread would be pretty ultimate.
I know a few natural dyers who have done a bedspread. Once you start going super large scale, you really have to be methodical of how you're bundling something,
Sure.
because you've got all this material that needs to essentially be rolled onto itself, and it starts to wrinkle, the resist starts to get in the way. So you kind of have to be mindful about how you do it,
Yeah.
so that you can maintain that really clear print quality. Now, some dyers don't care about that. Some dyers love the kind of messy, wrinkled eco print or bundle dye, and like to each their own. But I tend to be more of a perfectionist and want that very clear print. To me, it is about the print. So I'll limit how much yardage I actually do in one go. But I can continue to do that same amount over and over and over again. It's just, I'm not going to bundle 6 yards of fabric. That sounds like a nightmare.
You'd need a full-on cauldron, like an
Yeah.
outdoor fire to steam it.
Yeah, exactly.
So I imagine when you're learning all of this, you probably start trying to use every little leaf and berry or flower that you could find to get a print. And at what point did you decide you wanted to grow your own garden?
Oh, that was actually like a pretty easy decision. Because I was basically having to wait for other gardeners' flowers to flower so that I could like go buy some blooms off of them. But once we moved from New York to Florida, then all of a sudden I was in a climate where I could grow everything I needed to grow.
Right, all year long.
And so I immediately started digging up the ground, working on the soil, learning how to start seeds, learning how to nurture the dye plants, because different plants need different things. And that was its own, moment of learning. And to me, that was also kind of like the dying. It was like endless, and all I wanted to do was like figure it out. You never figure it out. You just figure out how to like solve the issues that you run into, like pests or powdery mildew, things like that, which I'm sure you know all about.
Oh yeah. That's my forte. That's part of why, I'm a gardener and I love plants so much. I haven't actually planted, like you're talking about starting perennial flowers from seed. That's something that I haven't delved into very much because my specialization is edible landscaping. But that I've heard that that's really challenging. And some of them have really, really long germination periods.
Some of them, yeah. I think I had one that was like a 10-day termination. And I
Not
just
too bad.
waited and they all sprouted, and then I was like, all right, it just teaches you patience in a different way. So, yeah, the gardening is like a full-time love of mine. And then when things start to bloom and you can start to use those flowers, that's the climax of it all.
Yeah. I would love to see some pictures of your garden. If you have those to share, I can link them to this episode.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to share those.
Do you have any favorite plants that are your like main allies for your art?
Yes, I would say one of the prints that I'm kind of known for is the hardy hibiscus print. So, it's this really large hibiscus flower. They call it a dinner plate, because it's the size of a plate. They print so well. And because I can grow them both here alongside tropical hibiscus, I've just got these really rich, big flower prints on the silk. And I would probably say that those are one of my favorites, just because the richness of color and the detail that the fabric picks up from each petal is outrageous.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of those, I believe, on your Instagram page that are so stunning.
Yeah, I love them. So I've got five hardy hibiscus plants that are sprouting right now, and I'm just like, come on, guys, grow, 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 because I just can't wait for them to start blooming. That's when the magic really starts to happen for me.
Yeah. Do you have, what do you do with the plant parts after you're done? Are you like composting them? Do you have chickens you feed them to?
I don't have chickens. I would compost them, but because they're technically cooked, after you steam them, it doesn't go into the compost. I honestly just go and shake the fabric outside, and the petals just land in the grass or in
Right.
the yard, and then that's where they go.
Nice.
And
That works.
they're really slimy. Some of them just like completely just fall apart after they've been steamed. So yeah, just shaking them in the wind is like the best method.
Yeah. So is your business your primary source of income, or is it more of a side hustle slash passion project that you do because you love it?
It depends. Right now I'm taking a break from academia, but I was an adjunct professor of art and art history. So that's my main love. And then this is also like, a part-time job. The goal is for it to definitely be more full-time. And so we'll see kind of how it morphs into teaching. I love being my own boss. I love, having my own schedule. And
Absolutely.
yeah, so we'll see how it kind of evolves over time.
Maybe classes and books in the future.
Yeah. Definitely, definitely more classes.
Yeah. So where can people find you to buy your beautiful products or take a class from you?
So Instagram is a great place. It's Sydney Goss Silks, really simple. And then my website is sydneygosssilks.com, and we're working on launching that the shop for like June 1st.
Okay.
Yeah, I just did an article with Garden and Gun, and so that'll be in the June July issue.
Nice.
So launching the shop when that also hits is my big goal. That's
Okay.
also when I'm going to be having my daughter. So
Oh my gosh.
it'll be a busy month.
Yeah, congratulations. I'm so excited for you.
Yeah, thank you.
Have you been printing tons of baby clothes?
Everyone asks me that, and no.
You'll
Honestly,
just swaddle her in silks.
yeah, and I have so many that I can choose from. But yeah, the baby clothes thing, I just don't know. I just don't have an urge to do it. Which is funny, to be honest. But
Fair enough. You got to feel how you're feeling.
yeah. And I was so sick during the first part of my pregnancy that the mordant smell just I couldn't get over. So thankfully that's gone.
Yes, definitely. Do you offer remote classes for people who aren't in your area?
Yeah, so I don't do a large remote class, but I do offer one-on-one like remote dye consultations or a full series of like a dye workshop with someone one-on-one. And I've done a few of those, and they've been very successful for both myself and the person that's taking the class, because they can get one-on-one, instruction from me. Answers to all those like nitty-gritty questions
Yeah, absolutely.
that you have when you're starting to figure out like what a mordant is, like we were talking about earlier. Instead of having to do your own research and you're finding all these different blogs that have different answers, I can just give you those answers because I've already figured it
Yeah,
out. So,
absolutely. That's so valuable.
yeah.
Okay, well, I'm going to link to all of your contact information in the show notes, and I have learned a ton just in our conversation now. And I'm so grateful that you took your time today.
Yeah.
I will let
Thank
you
you so
get
much
back
for
to it.
having me.
Absolutely. Enjoy the rest of your evening and your weekend as well.
You too.
All right, bye.
Bye.